Welcome to Nature Now, an original production by KPTZ volunteers. Nature Now is a program of information and insights about the natural history of our region. We welcome observations and suggestions from our listeners, care of naturenow@kptz.org.
Hello, welcome to Nature Now with Mary Robson and Nora Petrich, and something coming up soon. Nature Now celebrates 500 shows the first week in February. Our all-volunteer team has brought visions to you of the miniature and the huge, with interview guests providing a tremendous range of knowledge and expertise. Be sure to join us for this early February show, because your listening has brought us this far. Our guest today is Bob Jepperson, the author of Wild Love Story, and capable of many, many things. Bob brings us living observations of his world, acreage on Fidalgo Island, in nearly daily visits over more than 10 years. He photographs, records the sound, and writes about the place and its inhabitants. His book, Wild Love Story, weaves together what he observes, intimately bringing the sights and sounds of the place to the reader. His pages include spots where a phone can open the sound accompanying the picture, which I have to say that my 15-year-old granddaughter, she just enjoys it all the time. But first, as you expected, a mystery sound. This is a clue. This bird has recently been seen in a local eruption. Not the volcanic sense of the word, but I-R-R-U-P-T-I-O-N, eruption, a particular word relating to birds. And now we will have the pleasure of talking with Bob Jepperson. Welcome, Bob.
Hi, Mary.
Hi there. You know, we mentioned when we talked before that it occurs to me that many people are not able to do what they want most to do during this pandemic. But it seems to me that you have had relatively few changes to your life exploration of the forests and ponds near your home. And I wondered if you could walk us through getting into the forest and the ponds and tell us perhaps your favorite place that you visited after all these years.
Well, the trail usage has gone up with the pandemic.
Interesting.
More people, in fact, they had to limit the number of cars at the trailheads at one point. Behaviors have changed. People are real good. We look for each other far ahead and then step off the trail 10 or so feet. There's one user group, the runners, who are a problem for me because I think they're concerned about their watch and how fast they can get through the trails. But other than that, people are wonderful and we still stop and visit. I have many favorite places. We have 3,000 acres and 50 miles of trails. I usually end up every day for a while at the Big Beaver Pond. It's one of a number of beaver ponds that we have. It's the largest, I don't know the size, maybe 10 acres. And of course, at one time, it was a creek through the forest and beavers had been trapped out. Like they were in so many places. But when trapping ended and the beavers came back, then they built dams and the creek flooded the valley and trees that were in the water died. And all that remains are a few cedars that are still standing because they're more rot resistant. And those cedars create a vertical habitat that's wonderful. I'll be sorry when all of them go over. And the Big Beaver Pond is right now as smooth as glass, uncluttered, but that won't be for long because we'll have a new sprouting from this network of reptilian looking roots that cover the bottom of our beaver ponds. And they're going to send up a new set of shoots, two types, blossom shoots and leaf shoots. And by April, for sure, the pond will be covered, not with the kind of lily pads that are in children's stories that the frogs sit on. A few of them do stay flush with the water like that, but most of them with the great yellow pond lily keep growing, and it elevates the leaves a foot to 2 feet, maybe more, above the water. So in a way, it's like a wet forest out there, and it provides wonderful cover for those who want it, and a lot of places where they can forage for insects that cling to the stems and the leaves. The ducks prefer to raise their ducklings out there because the eagles are less likely to be able to get at them. So every year, the beaver pond is wonderful to watch, to go from its current condition of clear, flat water to absolutely cluttered with pond lilies.
Bob, are the beaver continuing to alter the conditions of that great pond? I mean, is it, they're still working there, so is it changing time and again?
They do. I often enter the forest from what's called the A Avenue parking lot, and it's city there. But as soon as I enter the forest, I'm on about a 10-foot wide road for 100 yards. And then I take a right onto a trail that's narrower. And then I cross a little footbridge next to a beaver dam. And then I enter a wonderful trail that's kinky and crooked and loaded with hazards like rocks and slippery roots and trees so close that I can bump into them. And then I'm truly in the forest. And I go a couple of hundred yards. You can only access the big beaver pond on foot. No bicycles, no horseback, and of course, no motorcycles on that trail. And I can see a hole in the woods ahead of me. And when I arrive, and I usually sneak through that hole, I see whatever's out there. Beaver in the evening, late evening, waterfowl. Right now, a pair of swans. For some reason, every year, a pair of swans comes and gives up all the social life they could have over on the farmlands with thousands like them. And this year they came with no young. Yeah, some years they come with one, two. One year they came with five.
Are these trumpeter swans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're trumpeters. We have tundra and trumpeter over on the delta, but these are always the trumpeters, the large ones. And the condition of the big beaver pond is healthy right now. The beavers who created it have a series of dams on two outlets. Yeah, there's two on one outlet and there's four dams on the other outlet. And they have the primary dams, the one that sets the level of the big beaver pond, right up to snuff. In fact, they're a couple inches higher than usual. They've added a little more mud and sticks to the top over the winter. And as of December 20th, I've declared the beaver pond full. And it takes a while. When the fall rains come, most of the water soaks into the soil in the forest. And once the soil is saturated, then there's runoff. Then the creeks start to run into the big beaver pond. And as it fills and reaches the top of the dams, then we get water spilling over the dams. And then it's truly runoff. Then it ends up in Fidalgo Bay. The beavers are also actively marking their territories. And I know they don't have a calendar like we do, but they have one that works as well. And the length of the daylight day must tip them off every year that it's time to add new musk and mud and sticks and leaves to the top of their scent mounds. The largest scent mound, they're shaped like Mount Rainier, just about that slope and shape. And they crawl up there. If there's snow on the ground, it really gives them away because they leave their footprints up to the top. And they bring up mud from the bottom of the pond, and then they excrete some musk on top of it. And other beavers know then that Joe has marked his territory, and we better be aware of Joe. And then there, you know, there's the usual, the chewing, the repairs to their lodge. They have a large lodge. And when you arrive at the big beaver pond, if you look at the opposite shore, you'll see a giant mound and it's attached to the shoreline. Some of the beaver lodges in our forest lands are islands and some of them are peninsulas, I guess you'd call them. They're attached to the shoreline.
What you're saying basically is that winter beaver activity is directed toward the improvement or living in what they've already created.
Well, yes. And they're always chewing on wood. They don't have any pond lilies to chew on this time of year. All the stems have been released. In fact, there's kind of a wonderful aesthetic going on along the shorelines right now, because as those reptilian roots, which are about the diameter of a small cantaloupe, once they release the stems, then they drift in the wind on the surface of the water and they collect on the shoreline. And it looks like a snake pit of green undulating snakes.
Is there anything that eats that once it has washed up on the shore?
Well, beaver eat pond lilies, all parts of it, from the roots on up. And the roots, when they first, some of them break loose from the bottom, especially with the beaver yanking on the stems, which they do. When they float to the surface, they're kind of woody. And I've heard beaver a number of times chewing on them. They'll bring a root to the shoreline and chew on it like a piece of wood. And then after they begin to decay, they almost turn gelatinous. And if you pick one up, it's like in two hands, it would be like holding a giant sea cucumber across your two hands. They get limp and jelly-like.
Well, this brings up the question that we talked a little bit about how winter happens this time of year in this particular latitude. We haven't had much frozen weather. I've had my bird baths freeze solid a couple of times, but mainly it feels rather mild. And how do you interpret winter through what you see in this forest?
Mm-hmm. We had a very warm winter too. There were two occasions when the Big Beaver Pond had a thin skim of ice over the whole top, enough for the waterfowl to leave. Its effect is mostly what I see on amphibians. Right now, the red-legged frogs are like racehorses in the starting gate. They're poised in the forest to run to the ponds, actually hop to the ponds. And if they all head downhill, they end up at water. And if they end up in the water, they see and hear each other, especially hear each other, even underwater. And that will happen in about 2 weeks. If the temperature is about 50 degrees, the red-legged frogs will come out of the forest, head to water, and then they'll collect around the females. And they hang on to the females, but fertilization happens in the water, similar to the way it does in salmon. And the egg masses are just such good news. For 2 years now, the salamanders and the red-legged frogs have been frozen out. So they left the forest when the temperature and the time was right. And then water temperature continued to drop. And they had to bail out and go back in the forest and then try again when things warmed up.
But does that affect the ultimate success that they have in mating and producing more frogs and more salamanders?
It has. You know, I would say 3 years ago, I could stand in one place and count up to 40 baseball to softball size masses of Northwest salamander eggs without moving.
Wow.
And last year, I was lucky if I could see one or two in the good spots. And they are so important in the food chain. I'm writing up that section right now, and I have so many pictures of owls with salamanders and frogs in their mouth, even kingfisher with a frog in his mouth, and of course, herons and otters, and they suffer tremendous casualties at the hands of predators. So they need to reproduce in large numbers.
Wow, I hadn't really thought of salamanders and frogs as being such major nutrient items for other animals. But
they are, especially in the owl kingdom, they are especially for barred owls. And if you read about barred owls in a book, it'll say that they're frequently found near water. But the details are interesting. They do most of their predation on aquatic species when they have fledglings to feed. And that's the time of year when the water is warm and the salamanders and the crayfish are near the surface feeding. And so barred owls will hunt from a perch and watch the water. It's usually where I watch them covered with duckweed, and they see the tiniest little disturbances on the water, and they'll watch and they'll lean forward, and then they'll shift their feet, and then they'll launch. and take, they can take either of those species off the water and then keep going. They just snatch them off and then go to a perch, and they either eat the prey themselves or they have noisy, hissing fledglings nearby that get their prize.
So what we're doing as we think about looking at the pond is carrying it a little forward in time to say March, a little bit into April. Is there anything else happening now? I really hadn't thought about the red-legged frogs being frozen out, for example, where there's a sudden change in the weather. Is there anything else happening that would make us think of this as being a season that is in progress, not a winter that just shuts down, but something that's progressing?
Yes. And by the way, the frogs manage to get out of the water before it forms ice on top. They bail out before the temperature reaches freezing. Two other things. Let's see. One in the plant kingdom is wonderful. And that's the, I hate to use the term skunk cabbage. I call them golden bog lanterns or bog lanterns. There are plenty of options. They're too wonderful to deserve the name skunk cabbage. Anyway, their shoots, they come up like spear points, like the Washington Monument, and they're green at first, and right now they're almost a foot tall.
Really?
And by next month, we'll have some blooms. So we'll have banana yellow giant blooms out there for quite a while, quite a few weeks.
They are obviously one of the very first things that I think of when I think of walking in a forest that has a stream in very, very early spring. Are there any animals, or are you aware of any that use that plant either edibly or in some other way?
If you include insects as an animal, which you should,
the
reason why they smell the way they do is to attract insects. And that structure that has hundreds of little blossoms on it needs pollinizing. And so that's done by insects.
Which leaves another place for something like a bird that uses an insect for food.
Yes. And in the animal kingdom, of course, I'm a little bit owl-centric in my focus over there, but not entirely. Right now, the great horned owls are courting. And people who do not have a chance to hear the sounds they make during courtship, all year long, great horned owls are quite consistent in their vocalizations. Their five-note call or slight variations on it is the call they use year-round. But during courtship, hormone-fired vocals vary a little. And if people go to my website, bobjepperson.com, and open the sound link page, I have recordings of the sounds they make when they're courting. And it's wonderful and dramatic. As wonderful and dramatic as the courtship sounds of great horned owls is, barred owls probably exceed them. And in my book, Wild Love Story, I describe it as a crazy monkey duet. People would not know that they're courting owls. It's so strange, the sounds they make. And they can also hear that on my SoundLink page. So
what you have got in addition to the book you've written is years and years of accumulated sound that you have captured so that someone can go to bobjepperson.com and find it. Which is wonderful, because that's what I'm planning to do tonight. I didn't know that, but that's what I'm going to do.
That one page, the SoundLink page, drops down and there'll be 33 play buttons and 33 sonograms, a visual expression of the sound, and 33 paragraphs for context.
Wow.
So it isn't a simple thing like saying, this is what a great horned owl sounds like. It's more than that. It explains the situation. And then I have a variety of sounds that each of the two species of owls makes.
I am inspired to ask you, since I am a fan of your first book, Wild Love Story. You are working on a second, yes? Does it have a title or a theme, or is it a secret? Or where are we?
Well, you know, I didn't start doing this 11 plus years ago in order to write a book, but I wanted to bring home photos of the wonderful things I saw. So I got better at photography. And then 8 years ago, I added sound recording. So I have a parabolic reflector that's 22 inches across, stereo microphone, and a handy little recorder, digital, thank goodness. And then I write. And so it all just ballooned what I had brought home. And I put it together in a book. 2017 was when Wild Love Story came out. But in the past 3 years, things happen over there. And I still collect pictures, writings, and sound recordings. So I figured this year that it's probably time to put together another book. So yes, I'm working on it, trying to make sense of all this, these collections.
Well, and the wonderful thing is that your observations are captured. I observe things that I frankly forget about, but the fact is I don't think that you've ever forgotten anything that you ever observed. So,
oh no, my computer is in charge of memory. And I think, you know, I use Microsoft Word for my notes. And if I want to find out when, I first saw a wood duck arrive, I go to my wood duck folder, which could be 20 pages long, and enter first for the word search. And it yellow highlights every single one of my first observations. So that's the only way it becomes work. Some of my files are 94 pages long. I know one is. And so word search allows me to find things quickly.
Well, I am so glad that you joined us today. Every time we talk, I discover new ways to see the world around me that I thought I understood. So I'm very grateful, and we'll look forward to having you back again.
Well, that I would welcome that too. And it's always good to talk with you, Mary.
Thank you, Bob. Bye now. This gets us to our mystery sound. Which is a pine siskin. And I know from Nora alerting me that the pine siskin has been one of our mystery sounds relatively recently, but there is something going on with them. They are sparrow-sized birds, but they're in the finch family, and you would never see them immediately as finches because their beaks are smaller and more pointed, not heavy like the house finch. They move in flocks of various sizes. I've counted about 15 at a time on the edge of the woods this week. They're streaked brown, and they have distinct yellow on wings and tail, and they show very brightly when they move or fly. They are year-round residents here, but they seem to have erupted. And there's that word. An eruption is a dramatic, irregular migration of large numbers of birds. During the annual Christmas bird count here last month, the Olympic Peninsula Audubon Society counted a record-breaking number of pine siskins, 9,000 in the Squim Dungeness region, which is far beyond their previous record of 6,700 in 2007. And according to the National Audubon Society, 2020, according to them, will be known as the biggest eruption of northern finches in recent history, which gives you something else to think 2020 has done. So that's it for today. Thanks for joining us on Nature Now. You can hear Nature Now Wednesdays at 12:30. Thursdays during the 5 o'clock hour, and Saturday at 12:30. You can also listen to all of our shows on podcasts. Just check up kptz.org and look into Nature Now podcasts, and you can have endless fun doing that. Thanks very much to Nora Petrich, who kept us going today. And we look forward to joining you for our 500th show in the first week of February. Thanks. The closing song is Soon It's Gonna Rain, from a very long-running show called The Fantastics.
Hear how the wind begins to whisper. See how the leaves go streaming by. Smell how the velvet rain is falling. out where the fields are warm and dry. Now is the time to run inside and stay. Now is the time to find a hideaway where we can stay. Soon it's gonna rain. I can see it. Soon it's gonna rain. I can tell. Soon it's gonna rain. Then what are we gonna do? Soon it's gonna rain. I can feel it. Soon it's gonna rain. I can tell. Soon it's gonna rain. Then what'll we do with you? We'll find four limbs of a tree we'll build, four walls and a floor we'll bind it over the leaves, then duck inside to stay. Then we'll let it rain and we'll not feel it. Then we'll let it rain, rain pell-mell, and we'll not complain if it never stops at all. We'll live and love within our own form.